This is the early section from it. Last night's unlooked-for snowfall, effaced by noon in the tepid sun, a few damp tatters on straw-pale lawns, rags of a cloud the weather prophets misconstrued. We set out late, unlikely party, dog leading out, black and white cat skittering after, me bringing up the rear. The ramp to despair lies thinly veiled. The dog descends, then the cat, enchanted, lofting her tail like a sable banner. Though the ice protests, though dark rents race from her forepaws, the bitch can't help from snuffling farther onto the crust. What lures her on? What redolence of dog piss and garbage lurks in the channel, marking what passage across the ice? What calls her to this lovely rubble, this kingdom of litter, this slovenly Walden, improbable Hippocrene? Thrust through the scrim, her nose is moist as a newborn pup's, nuzzling the current that rushes down the corridors of darkness under the steadfast, irrepressible present. A quarter mile downstream, a cavernous yawn, so vast it might swallow a house. The current quickens as slim despair sidles into the darkness and disappears, muttering like distant traffic, down sunless sewers improvised by man, feeling her way toward far Carondelet. Twice 5 miles downstream, at the mouth of despair, the wind drives slate-blue cumulus up from the gulf, rattling the milkweed pods on the cyclone fence where the left bank wells its casual effluent into the bottle-green water. What shades still haunt that sullen country Chief Ruensa christened Land of Life, that headland crowned with burdock, scorched brown mullein, ironweed, poverty grass? Great gouts of steam escape one slender stack of Great Lakes carbon, fluttering a pennant of cadmium orange flame. To reassemble from those grimy vertebrae the shore that charmed Ruensa and Long Neck, Kaskaskias, Tamaroas, trappers and pears, Frenchmen, Spaniards, Yankees, to resurrect the stands of white oak, sweet gum, honey locust, sycamores, willows, and buckthorn thickets that snared the fathers, Marest, Pinet, and Gravier, trappers of men themselves, a task to tax the craft of the most pious Jesuits of debris. In lieu of annals, this alluvium, no monuments, only dolmens of rubble, burbling round the slime-furred stones, despair slinks, shameless, American as an auto graveyard. The sunset stains the color of rancid salmon. From the sewer, a hint of industrial bouquet. In the westerly breeze, a green cloud glides like a glaucous gown along her thigh. Down the ramp to the cavern and back, performing our daily unforced march, me and the dog and the black and white cat, from house to river, river to house, contriving somehow never to tread the identical perception twice. Overhead, a cardinal cheers her scarlet flag in a tattered larch. And toward the end, a poem called His Kingdom at Last, which contains one of my favorite epigraphs of all time, from Michael Frayn, the playwright. It isn't the despair. I can stand the despair. It's the hope. This expedition is my breather. This passage, my rest. This hill of keys, my Beardmore. This house, my wilderness, bristling with aborigines, marbled with fortuitous ore. Despair is a river you wade through more than twice, naked or ice-clad, putrid or pristine, sluggish or flooded, according to the season. Despair is a bed you lie in and die in, climb from every morning. Hope is a comforter riddled with holes to pull over your eyes. Change is a bedsheet your wife smooths over the bedsheet every Saturday, a little grayer from tossing, softer from laundering. Free not only of hope, but of expectation, having relinquished the future utterly, straddling the floor of a mine shaft or a grave or a river or a furnished room, eyes wide, bare feet tingling in the early chill that whistles through a crack in the window pane. Home free, the cat curls by the register. The dog makes for the kitchen, in case, in our absence, her immaculate dish has burgeoned with ambrosia. The beasts seem wilder than ever and more contented. I feel my cheeks glow like a furnace, my fingers seethe with quickened blood. Past hope at last, beyond, behind, beneath, above despair, we've landed here on the far side of the future, back in the radiant, dangerous, unequivocal present, beyond question, beyond belief, beyond a shadow of a doubt, still traveling, a black and white cat for my companion, a border collie for my guide. There is another shore, you know, upon the other side. I stole, of course, that last line, as I've stolen about half of what I'll read to you tonight, but I won't tell you when. I wanted to read the first section of another long poem. I tend to be writing long poems these days, but I promised, as I said, not to read all of any one of them. This one was also affected by by an area, by a place. This place is far from the River Despair. It's in southern Vermont. It's called In the Clearing. And I'm just going to read the first section of In the Clearing. It's a summer poem, as you can tell with the first line. Independence Day, while for us the bugle sounds retreat. Down in the schoolyard, the fathers are offloading rockets, whereas off to the left, a pile driver hasn't quit yet. An implacable whap, whap of the hammer, a drum fire of progress. At the tip of each quivering dendrite dance 10,000 angels brandishing rapiers or strumming molecular harps. Here in the clearing, hemmed in by honeysuckle, beleaguered by insults and promises, toxins and prophecies, switchblades and pheromones swarming at every pore, it's keep treading, private, to pause is to drown. Surrounded by windflower, speedwell, sweet yellow clover, we can let the angels enter one at a time. Few weeds are tolerant of shade. It was man who opened the sunny spots where weeds are happiest. How good to be back at headquarters, back at the threshold between the labyrinth and the wilderness, one chaos and another, where mornings are sunny, evenings pensive, nights incontestable, on speaking terms with ragweed and sow thistle, skullcap, burdock, bitterroot, and nettle, intimate, familiar, thick as thieves. Time was I made way for my cohorts, slashing and burning from here to the capital, without respite, without reflection. How sweet to be home again with my people, a consummate, sovereign, irresistible weed. Sundance the cat will no doubt be your first concern, as he will insist upon being fed. That was one of the notices in the house. Who is this dark lover come calling, this inky Maharaja, behind whom the underbrush is a palisade of blackberry and goldenrod? Black as the lips of silence, it's Sundance, strolling his minimalist grove, 15 red maples and 3 white pines, 18 dryads dancing on the barbered grass, a 3-dimensional frieze on an animate urn. He called this morning with a gift in his mouth, a vole, clasping and unclasping the shadow in its elf-gray hand. Who's feeding whom? What's Sundance's first concern? Unsettling how much the front door shut between us, his cry of triumph sounded like a howl of pain. What things soever you desire, when you pray, believe that you receive them and you shall have them. Reviewing the troops on the shelves of the upstairs study, have you felt like giving up lately? Are you confused? The hunger for reality. I can all but savor the tang of the owner's convictions wafting from the pages. Penciled in the margin of how to pray, prayers of 2 or more when feeling the same burden are very strong. And down in the living room, living in step, hey, I'm alive, the total woman, the book of trees, and what have we brought for sustenance? 1 copy of Chaos and 2 Rogers. All the plants will need watering. I will probably leave a few in the kitchen sink. In baskets, basins, clay pots, plastic, garden soil, potting soil, vermiculite, water, huddled on benches, railings, tablings, lurking on windowsills, dangling from rafters, blooming, drooping, lush, tubercular, some under the weather, such as there is in here, some bushy-tailed, fresh as a hothouse daisy, yet all of them docile, self-deprecating, hushed and trusting, as if they were expecting us, housebroken like them, rich kin from the interior. The pond looks pretty only after a big rainstorm. There are apparently no underground springs, despite what the builder told me. Some pond, a crater in the grass with a bed of dusty mud tiles, flaunting that valence of lavender mimulus, a sort of dysfunctional rain trap, a brontosaurus print, an old war wound, and above, closing in on every side, that siege of horsemint and heelall, speedwell, skullcap, and wild marjoram, flourishing pennants of purple and blue, closing in like a legion of militant weeds. Sundance is cutting through the maples, reconnoitering, appraising with his pale green, non-Euclidean eye the lay of the land. Now he steps from the shadow and lets the trees get on with it, reading the future with their clairvoyant roots, praying to the dark star at the heart of their darkness. Sunlight leaps from his flank, a fusillade of shooting stars. Walden is blue at one time and green another, even from the same point of view. Last night's rain has beaten the mimulus flat as a blanket. The floor of the pond is weeds from shore to shore, ripples of jopai weed and wild marjoram, ghost minnows of violet and lavender winking and flickering. If I'd a mind, I'd walk across it. Strange bird haranguing us from the evening wood. One three-note measure echoed relentlessly till even our obstinate hearts begin pounding in triplets. That's the end of the first section. It goes on just enjoying the clearing. We all need a clearing every once in a while, especially after the chaos. The last section from which I want to read is a long poem called The Analects of Bone. What happened was that I'd always been interested, as some of you may know, in caves. The other thing I'd been interested in was art. So sooner or later, I was going to get interested in art in caves. And I started to try to read about the painted caves in southern France and in Spain. I've never visited them. In fact, I try as hard as I can to stay as close to my study as I can and do most of my burrowing there. But in the process, I learned all kinds of odd things about at least what people believe was going on in those caves. Among other things, I learned that there is a theory that the painters in the painted caves were shamans, and that what they were producing were in some way in the interest of shamanic rites. I see here I have some quotes early on, one of which was, perhaps the eternal figure of the creative artist with his ability to find an approach to spheres that are inaccessible to the average man comes closest to the meaning of the shaman. That was by somebody trying to explain or justify that theory. Another one, the artist had to take all sorts of positions to make his drawings from, lying on his back or on his side. Positions we have to assume in order to see the pictures. That seemed like an interesting thought. That made me want to think I would go there and at least get in the same position. For instance, if you try to get in the positions that I get into trying to write a poem in order to understand one, you might get the same result. And the last of those epigraphs for the whole collection, still there the pictures are, they exist, and my feeling is that one must have it out with them, so to speak. This is my attempt to have it out with the paintings. The whole sequence is called The Analects of Bone. It's partially explained by the first of these poems, which is called These Bones, which begins also with an epigraph. And of course, it's just larded with such epigraphs. And as I said, I won't bother to indicate it. I could put quotes in the air, but it doesn't seem worth it. These Bones begins with famous little epigraph from Ezekiel. And he said unto me, Son of man, can these bones live? At Le Moustier, one drowses with his head on his forearm, wild cattle bones all round him, a pile of flints for a pillow, an axe by his hand. In La Chapelle aux Saints, another curls like a fetus by the leg of a bison, buried with the flesh still on it, in case he gets hungry. Whereas at Teshiktash, it's a child's thigh bone that bears the butcher's signature. What drove the flint as it sawed through gristle and sinew? And the shaman under the stone at Shanidar, prostrate on his bed of cornflowers, yarrow, and hollyhock? What's left for us there but ossicles and pollen? Conditions for the preservation of bones are good in the calcium-rich environment of the limestone cave. Tenderly, meltwater, age on age, weeps in the crevices, laving the odds and ends of time. Really, it seems to be more of a graveyard than an honest-to-goodness rock. A regular old testament of mandibles and ammonites, browsed by brittle stars and whiskered fish, a petrified memory, a bone concordance, the analects of bone. Under the dead weight of history, the bones of the ancestors mend. This one is called In the Bony Labyrinth. It begins with this quote: "Do not look for them floating loose in the sea. They are in you and me. They created us, body and mind. Blow out your light and listen. Can you hear them? The amaranthine dead, swimming in every cell like chromosomes, murmuring their interminable admonitions. Can you feel the breakdown nuzzling your boot soles? Can you hear the little breaths departing? Could you find your way out even now? Those terrible salvos were loosed in your heart. Far down, groundwater taps with her tiny hammer." Some of them still echo, some of these passages still, I guess, echo with my experiences in caves that I did enter. This one is called Family Portrait. Next door in the cave at Les Trois Frères, another shaman teeters over the celebrants, antlered, bear-clawed, wolf-eared, bison-bearded, a horse's tail in hominid trotters. Old bricoleurs, they've forged themselves an ancestor with balls. In the belly of death, there's a dance in the old bones yet. One of the things that fascinated me, there's one painting that I think kept attracting me throughout and puzzling me throughout, which is in Lascaux. And it's in a place called either the Well or the Shaft. And it shows in most of the photographs, and again, I'm in a situation in which all I have are photographs to go by, a rather crude-looking man, apparently on his back, with a rather elegant heart on, and a bird head, and seemingly hovering over him, a bison who seems to have been speared and whose bowels are pouring out of his belly. I've seen one photograph that indicates that he's not lying down at all, and it really was a matter of you're not lying down to see what it really looks like if you were only painting the way the painter painted it. And he's really standing sort of like this. He's not lying on his back at all, sort of the way a bullfighter might stand. Go ahead, as bullfighters often do when the bull is just about ready to collapse, and not until. at least I've noticed that. It begins with a quote from Richard Leakey describing that, that. It's called The Prime and Basic Question. The mystery of Lascaux deepens with a curious scene depicted on the wall of the Well in the apse. A man lies dead between the figures of a wounded bison and a rhinoceros. Unlike the animals in the cave, the man is sketched in stick form, He has four fingers at the ends of his matchstick arms, and his face looks like a beak. Near him lies a pole with a bird perched at the top. One more trip to the well, belly down on the belly-smooth slab, clinging where a thousand hands have clung a moment before letting go in the midst of the paths, in the midst of the winds. Dousing with your seventh sense, hunting the undercurrent, hunting the daybreak down in the taproots of shadow, digging the dead. Ask, why is the bison turning his head? The better to gore its tormentor or admire its own entrails? And where might a rhino go but round and round here in the mountain's bowels, in the depths of vertigo? What's the shaman dreaming back of that beak? The eagle's stoop or the heron's ecstasy? The prime and basic question is this man really falling over backward? Is he dying, a hunter down with his prey? Is he on his back or up against the wall? What has he done with his thumbs? How does he manage that javelin or feed his beak? And why has he a hard on like a hangman? And that bird thing beside him, erect on its pole, does it point us the way in or out? If you take the ladder in the photo as our true north, the figure is standing upright, his back to the edge of the page, his brisket thrust at the horns, more like a matador than a moribund stalker. The humans are, to put it mildly, scruffy little figures. See, grandfather, he grunts, how I throw out my arms, just me and my scrawny thorax, my swagger stick, and my cuckoo camouflage. How you peer at your wound, grandfather, who dies that I may live. Your entrails spill in great canonical loops. What is this cave but a hollow in earth's bones? Your image fills like some immortal marrow. And this one probably, it's called Feeling Back, begins with an epigraph that I think probably sets the tone for what I was looking for in the cave. It's a quote from Ernest Fenollosa, a student of Oriental poetry that was made famous in translation by Ezra Pound. He said, "The chief work of literary men in dealing with language, and of poets especially, lies in feeling back along the ancient lines of advance." And what the poem is describing, in some caves, in quite a number of caves, there are outlines of hands. Either what you will have is the hand itself, probably covered with some sort of grease and red coloring in most cases, pressed on the walls, or more likely the other way around, the hands put against the wall and powder blown on against them to make an outline through, let's say, a hollow bone. Many of the hands seem to be missing parts of fingers or whole fingers. Feeling back. In the cave of Maltravieso, high on the water-smooth wall, a stone-gray hand on a bloodstone ground. Somebody signed his hand in the visitor's book, having first lopped off the tip of his middle finger and left the cave red-handed, gloved in blood. Dancing in the torchlight, our shadows flutter and plunge. The meanings of hands cannot be exactly determined. They are manifold. I don't think they caught that pun. In the beginning was the hand, beckoning, verbing, as a hand verbs a stream-washed stone, as a hand verbs lice from an infant's hair. While the tongue muttered in his cave, his barbarous argot, fit for derelicts and churls, the hand composed her tropes, seamless as water, in whose mirror we read the hieroglyphs of silence. Ghost of a Prayer. This one does refer, in fact, to a contemporary, the quote refers to a contemporary Russian or Siberian shaman. Suddenly the shaman began to imitate a bear's way of walking, and his song suggested its roar. "Hello, it is me, Uncle," Tubiaku said to this spirit. "Au, uau, antina, mantina, hakua," the bear growled in reply. I've never met a bear like that, fortunately. Wizard, through whose beard the old ones sing, whose fingers tease the bison from the stone, whom death's undone like a slipshod knot, if only he'd lend a hand with his confounded tangle. One is faced by a maze of undecipherable lines. Even under sharp light, sifting figures from the confusion demands guesswork. It's hard to tell his contours from the cave, worried from the fretwork some Stone Age centaur, lost as you're lost in this rat's nest of passages, a thread of acrid smoke for a companion. The rock face is more than a surface for the paint. It is the boundary line of this world and the world beyond. No boundary where he is, between flying and falling. The old ones might be roots as birds, boulders as unicorns. Upstairs, some hooligans dragging an angry line across the landscape with his heel. One of the great functions of poetry is to awaken the dead. Lining the walls like the mummies of Guanajuato, mouths agape, as if death had prized them open, in the shadowy corridor, the dead are singing, toothless as newborns, toneless and terrible. Laved by the waters of forgetfulness, lit by the shaman's torch in the cave of sleep, you've forgotten whatever it was that remained of you after everything else had been rinsed away. This is the next, well, there are about three more. This one is called Moving On and begins with an epigraph from a book on caves by Franklin Folsom. All scientists agree there is a kind of life cycle of caves, moving on from birth through maturity, even to death, in which something that was a cave becomes something that is not a cave at all. In dry, dead cave, the silence stops your ears with her dispassionate fingers. Not the faintest love tap from a stalactite, not the least whisper of groundwater kissing the fissures. Long ago, the pale cave cricket learned to hold his peace. Without your lamp, you can't tell where you end and the darkness begins. Apart from one polychrome arpeggio, you can play on an eyelid with the tip of your finger. Later, wedged in impassable crack, you revel in the thump and hiss of your blood as it drifts down the corridors of your inner ear. Sometimes dead caves come back to life. Water begins to drip once more. Glistening new calcite forms around the papery skeletons of earlier stalactites. Change is endless. Later yet, the music of fresh, wet cave, the sound of one drop dropping in a still black pool. Under the corpse, pale roots, moist, languorous, probing her crevices. Sudden fragrance of rain on sun-parched pavement, moist kiss of flowstone on the wrist, young cave, jeunesse, even the name is feminine. Those, this one is called Keep It Light and begins with a quote from C.M. Bowra. Those who pursue a migratory or half-migratory life travel lightly with the fewest possible appurtenances, not merely that they may not be wearied with burdens, but that they may have their hands free to kill game at any moment. Traveling light, like light, unencumbered, hands free at any moment to launch a spear or stroke a thigh or finger a pebble. There are days you grow weary of treading water, wrapped in your history like a soggy overcoat, crawling with sea lice, riddled with outworn quarrels. Oh, to dance once more on the sun-kissed shingle. Oh, for a lightsome breeze in what's left of your hair. Oh, for a fistful of air and a mouthful of song. And finally, and I guess in some way this returns to me, speaking of various crevices, this one has to do with the threat of a biopsy in a rather unspeakable crevice. It's called On Your Way Out and begins with a really strange and wonderful reference by Mircea Eliade in a book on shamanism, describing one piece of shamanism that absolutely fascinates me. In the funerary mythology of the Malekula, a terrifying figure named Temes or Lehevhev awaits the dead man's soul at the mouth of the cave or beside a rock. Before her, drawn on the ground, is a labyrinthine design. And when the dead man comes near her, the woman obliterates half the design. If the dead man already knows, he finds the road easily. If he does not, the woman devours him. I don't know how the feminists feel about this image, but it strikes me as pretty threatening. You better learn both halves of the labyrinth before you die. That's all I can say. Most of us only know our own half, and not very well. The readings are obscure, frowns the thaumaturged. There's something occult in the blood. It's time, old man, for a spell of ultrasound. Speak to the nurse on your way out. As you cool your heels in her at her cubicle, you feel the breath of the catacombs on the back of your neck. You feel like a natural fool with that skull in your hand. Half an age, an ice age, mapping the labyrinth with a hand-me-down compass and a rusty chain, and you still can't bear to slow down or ask directions or hunker down and eavesdrop on the dead. All in good time, you'll be looking her right in the teeth. Fat Lilith, Lehevhev, La Belle Dame, whomever, as she sweeps that imperious heel through the rest of your life. Thanks.